All right, I'm Lisa Rubenstein.
So Lisa was the premier person in the world.
Oh, shit.
In implementation of quality improvement.
Right.
And she spent her whole life trying to do it in the VA.
Yeah, well, I've had a really interesting, fun time trying to do it in the VA. I must admit that sometime last night, I was sorry that I said that I would do this particular talk, because it's another bend of the mind to try to connect quality improvement implementation to comparative effectiveness. But I think it turned out to be interesting to me, and I hope to you. Please stop me at any time. You know, I can speed up or slow down, so I'd much rather that you ask things along the way. What I'm going to try to do is explore a framework for looking at efficacy, classical effectiveness, and QI effectiveness studies, and then think in more detail about literature synthesis for learning about QI and implementation effectiveness. So why are we focused on this now? I always feel like I have to show this slide because it was, I think, kind of keeps grounding why we have to keep pushing so hard in all these areas. Healthcare accounts for 20% of the GDP and 60% is from taxpayer dollars, which most people don't seem to kind of realize. And if you add that to the baby boom, that means something's going to change. And if we can't help with this, are we worth the investment? And how can we help if we don't tackle this area of implementation quality improvement, which can be frustrating and difficult, but I think is really also a place that the training that we have in this field and the skills that we have in this field can really help people who are trying to make things better. So I think, you know, right now it's a challenging time. It's either going to be beginning of new things or it's going to be a really nice sort of edifice that over time doesn't really weather the storm. To make a real difference, health services really has to assist in changing routine care. And comparative effectiveness comes in as a way to influence policy, but I think also needs to be a way to influence implementation and quality improvement, and the kind of top-down, bottom-up, continuous interaction that both of those entail. So what is quality improvement? An effort to change or improve the clinical structure, process, and or outcomes of care by means of an organizational or structural change. The meaning of that being that if you want routine care to change, you can't go and hold the hand of every provider and say, this is what you're going to do today. You have to put something around that provider that gets them to do the thing. And QI science being the study of methods to introduce, spread, maintain those kinds of organizational and structural changes that then would hopefully improve process and outcomes of care. What's implementation? What's different about implementation than quality improvement? Well, quality improvement, really, if you look at the field as a whole, has been very ambivalent about evidence. Most of the early writing in, for example, continuous quality improvement very specifically avoids mention of evidence. And you can, if you think about it, you can see why. People really didn't want to be weighed down by every time they do a survey, it has to meet some standard that can't be met. They don't want to slow things down by, you know, all kinds of arcane research things. On the other hand, now is a time when both quality improvement and clinical effectiveness kinds of worlds are being asked to make this match between the two. And implementation science is a study of methods to promote the systematic uptake of evidence into routine clinical practice. So what's comparative effectiveness? I was adding on one more term that was really can be complicated. So it's, according to PCORI, compares existing healthcare interventions to determine which works best for whom and under what circumstances. And according to ARC, it's helping you, the consumer, make better choices. And what is comparative effectiveness science? What are the things that are really included in that? And if you have an answer, please do provide it. This is what ARC says the seven steps of comparative effectiveness research are, and I bolded the things that seem most relevant to our current topic. So synthesizing current research is a key part. Promoting and generating new scientific evidence and analytic tools. Well, that seems to kind of cover a pretty big waterfront. And then translating and disseminating research to diverse stakeholders and interacting with citizens. So most of the steps in that whole thing really don't have to do with science, don't really tell us what the science is going to be for comparative effectiveness research. The two steps that look most scientific are those two. And the second one, as I said, yeah, go ahead.
The other thing about it is the seven steps. And ARC says that this is supposed to aid the consumer making decisions. Only the seventh step has anything to do with the consumer. It really seems like it's more aimed at the providers, doesn't it?
It does. It does. And that is definitely another tension. And if you look at what things are funded in comparative effectiveness, you can sort of see that split. They're kind of all over the place, and some of them stretch it one way toward providers or towards organizations. Some of them stretch it another way towards consumers and may not have anything apparently to do with effectiveness. So I think it's definitely an evolving area. And I know I overheard some of the political disputes about it. There were a lot of people in health services research and other areas who felt that it really should be defined narrowly, because otherwise it was going to disappoint people and get bogged down in too much politics. But on the other hand, if it's too narrow, the fear was that it would never show an impact. It would never move beyond being a narrow study of this intervention and that intervention in a very defined way. So both PCORI and ARC, if you read the minutes from the PCORI meetings or you read the stuff on the ARC website, they both do seem to agree that it has something to do with implementation, but all of that stuff is very unspecified. So a quality improvement science question is, can we learn from the literature? That really is a key part of comparative effectiveness research. And I think in this talk, I'm sort of hypothesizing that by looking at the literature, we can also help move the science of the field as a whole ahead. If we can't look at the literature, it's very hard to share anything across people. But the QII literature is diverse, its quality is variable, and its goals are variable. So I'm going to start by going back to an intervention framework, because otherwise, I get confused on where all these things intersect. So this is the framework as I see it, and feel free to argue, because I think we really have to do a lot of development in this field if it's gonna evolve to the point of using the science that really we could have available to it. So efficacy studies. Can an intervention improve health under optimal conditions? So that's, the classic one is the pill that gets tested and looked at for its effect. These studies are the backbone of clinical science. Their aim is to get rid of context and focus on the causal links. But because they optimize and neutralize context, they really are weakly linked to the real world. Someone else has to be responsible for using the information they provide. And in some cases, that works pretty well, but in an awful lot of cases, it doesn't. And I would say here, I may come back to this, but I have recently begun to think that we've really gotten lazy in medicine about randomized trials. We sort of say, well, can I think about context? Can I deal with the fact that somebody may be different than somebody else and some site may be different. It's too confusing. Let's do a randomized trial and we can wipe it all out. The quickest, I've seen that with fellows projects. I've seen that often. The easiest thing to do, just, you know, don't worry if you're going to get a negative study that really shouldn't be negative. Don't worry if you're not going to learn where to direct your intervention. Don't worry if it could have been much better for some people than others. Let's just randomize it all away. So I think that's one of the downsides to all of us having been brought up in the world of randomized trials and thinking of them as being a kind of a greater truth. I've done probably, I think, 8 or something of them, and I do like them. They're really very satisfying. But I think at this point we have to push ourselves beyond that. So if you look at this diagram, efficacy going to effectiveness. Classical effectiveness studies are, is the intervention effective in real-world contexts? So there's an intervention and there's a context. Context surrounds the intervention. And there's an effect. You can even have interventions that are tested for effectiveness that are multi-component, so that they include changing a part of context and they happen within a context of an organization or a practice or a set of patients and providers. So they can involve a lot of different designs, cluster randomized, quasi-experimental, advanced non-experimental observational studies. They generally would involve a partnership with some kind of organization because they're taking place in a more of a real-world setting. Their outcomes can be a lot of things like cost that we don't, you know, always think of in clinical trials. And they're affected by, they're just sort of designed to be affected by context. But the goal is not to change the setting. The goal is to find out if your thing works. Does collaborative care for depression improve outcomes in a specific set of patients and providers that go through that intervention? So, quality improvement. Quality improvement kind of can be seen as having a couple of different inputs. One is clinical problem solving, and that's really the way CQI thought about itself initially. You have a problem, you get people working on it, and you improve it. So that doesn't come from an evidence pathway. That comes from what do you see on the ground. And then there's an implementation pathway into quality improvement that looks at their effective interventions and how do they move into the world. And I would see comparative effectiveness research as being kind of part of quality improvement, embracing a part of quality improvement, embracing implementation, and embracing effectiveness studies. So what is a quality improvement effectiveness study? That's getting to, can the intervention change context to improve routine care? So then the intervention and the context are intertwined, really. And you're looking for not just whether something is more effective than another, but for some kind of impact on a population. So the QI study goal is to change the setting, and that's how I would see it being different from classical effectiveness studies. Because once you
say, I think you're muddling up two things.
Okay.
Context between effectiveness and efficacy is really about patient variables more than about organizational variables. So it's about not having a patient that's too old, too sick, too many diseases. It's not being relevant. It's really, I think, more about patient variables. Context in QI is really about organizational context. It has to deal with two things. It has to deal with both the, you're not going to change the patient variables you have to change the context of the patient, presumably, and say, I'm going to get rid of all women, even though we'd like to do that. You're not gonna do that if they're not controlled, you know, but you're not gonna do that. So it's really about changing the organizational context. So it has to deal with the two issues of...
Yeah, well, I can see it that way. I think for me it's simpler to see it the other way, because if you do an effectiveness study that's in a real-world context, there's got to be some way that you notice where you're doing it. So I see it as being where
you're...
I know,
but I don't think the field does. I really believe the difference...
I think that's quite possible.
I think the field really believes that the difference between effectiveness and efficacy tends to be the slew of articles that have been published that say you excluded old people, you didn't have any Asians, you didn't have, you know, A, B, C, or D, and they're different.
Yeah.
And they, in terms of what's going on. Well, or you had the best, you know, occasionally in the procedure world you get to, you handpick the surgeons and you train them, or you had a protocol, or you had that. But a large part of it is the patient variables, which you have to accept in quality improvement.
Right. Yeah, I think I just would broaden it a little, because otherwise I can't account for this other piece. It comes out nicely accounted for if I do it this way. Maybe there's a better word.
And why don't you believe quality improvements really started with science?
Well,
why do you believe that the people, you know, all the people that I know of that started the quality improvement thing started with the science? And they started with lots of organizational science.
If you look at the, in a way they did and in a way they didn't. If you look back at the early books, the Berwick books, if you look back at Deming, Deming talks about profound knowledge, but that's really the only place in those early frameworks that it comes in. And then this kind of slipped in because they started using QI for guidelines, for example. So guidelines are evidence, but it never really got hit on the head as part of CQI, where it would be thought of systematically. How do you put evidence into this?
The science is, it's not medical science that they were using, but it was a lot of statistical science. I mean, Deming talks about statistical things all the time, so I sort of agree with that, but it's not like it was a belief system, and then let's go ahead and do this because I believe in it.
No. That's a very good point. I agree with you totally. It's more the evidence, not the science, that I'm talking about. I was saying it doesn't systematically take in evidence, mm-hmm. which as a, you know, if you talk about comparative effectiveness, I think that particularly highlights that issue.
Wait a minute,
what
do you mean by that? Give me an example.
I should go off on that direction. Okay, if you look at the Breakthrough series, that was one of the first things that kind of tried to systematically put in guidelines and evidence, but there's no emphasis in the Breakthrough series, for example, on how do people get that evidence? Who represents it? Is it your favorite opinion leader? Is it a systematic review? None of that stuff is systematically dealt with in QI. There are many ways that evidence can go into a quality improvement intervention, including some sort of, you know, getting experts, some sort of looking at the literature.
Yeah, but you got to at least admit
behavioral.
That QI started from, you didn't say we're going to try to implement snake oil, which might work in preventing, hypertension. That might be effective, that it really did start from clinical evidence, right?
Yes.
So what you're talking about is you don't believe the implementation science had enough evidence of the various steps.
Well, I think it's more than that. I think that they took in evidence, but they didn't make it explicit. So it isn't, there was no formula in any of the recipes for CQI that said, you know, this is what you should...
So why didn't medicine take into evidence what Jack Walsh did in GE and fire the bottom 5% of everybody who performed every year?
That I don't know.
So is that what you're talking about? Is you're talking about business practices? Business practices have for a long time have emerged as, you know, it's not randomized trial evidence, but there's a lot of evidence
on
what you have to do to run an effective business.
I would count that.
Fundamental to QI is you have to have a starting place. You have to you can't, because if you're, if it's not something shown in evidence, then really what you're proposing is a research study to figure out if this will work.
Well, they would disagree, CQI would disagree with that, because the starting point in CQI is a problem.
I get that, but when you go to develop your intervention must be based on something that's been shown, and then now you're trying to figure out, will that work within this organizational system or structure?
No, that makes sense, but it hasn't been done that way. For example, the early studies on CQI for a number of things, including depression, were negative. And one thing, when you look at what happened in those studies, is they set a group of people going in a randomized trial, and they said, you guys should, you know, do something good about diabetes or depression. And they had no reference to the evidence, and the teams did kind of bizarre things, probably because, you know, they ran into barriers that hadn't been thought of, and they took the easier path, and they, you know, so you look at it later, and, well, gee, I mean, it's no biggie why they didn't have an impact, since they weren't doing anything that's known to have an impact. But there's not, in setting up those studies, for example, there's not a place that says, you know, we're going to test CQI, and the CQI has to be based on behavioral evidence, business plan evidence. I mean, I'm really talking about evidence in the broad sense, some sort of systematic way to think about evidence. And one of the things that we've been trying to do in some of our studies over time is figure out how you get evidence introduced in some way that doesn't undo the process, but gives it some broader view. I think this time we're doing this for the patient-centered medical home PACT, and we're working with Paul Schickel's Evidence-Based Practice Center, and we're doing rapid reviews, and we're kind of presenting them to the team, and that's like our third version of how to do this, and I think we're getting closer to a way to, you know, you want the teams to see, they've read a few articles on, say, 30-day calling people post-hospital discharge by the team, you know, that's one of the projects. So they've read stuff about that, but they are passionate, they want this thing to happen. So how do you say to them, look, there's a bigger world out there, the whole issue of discharge is a bigger topic, without stopping them in their tracks, but giving them a view of, you know, sometimes behavioral literature issues, sometimes more on post-hospital discharge. I think it's a...
Would you say then that QIs can be, I mean, there's informal, and it sounds like what you're describing there is a very informal QI that's not really, I mean, the standards of QI really are to bring the evidence in, at least that when I took the courses and things like that, I mean, that's how I was trained on it, was to really bring the evidence into it. Otherwise, if you're just dilly-dallying and trying to just throw something together, it's kind of an informal, and you don't really know what you're going to get, and there's no statistics in that, and where's your bias and all of that. and I think we do see a lot of that, particularly in hospital settings, where, you know, a lot of things are initiated. I wouldn't necessarily want to label that as CQI or QI, because I think it doesn't meet the definition of at least that.
We'll get to definitions. But I think all your points are good ones.
I don't really think that's the history of the field. I think the history of the field is that you had a bunch of arrogant SOBs called CEOs, most of them are doctors, who didn't give a damn. And there's lots of science out there. So they hired a bunch of incompetent people that couldn't get another job to basically do something they didn't care about. So when you put it in the science incorporated, I mean, there's an enormous science out there of how to change organizations if you really believe that you want an organization to produce something. There is no concept still at any organization that I know of almost that they really want to produce anything. I mean, nobody says to you, if I don't eliminate, I mean, I'm startled every day I meet with a leader at any organization, saying, you mean I really have to do something about a doctor that's not performing well? I mean, let alone going to where you are. So I think this is much simpler. I think it is, most of the work, a lot of the work was really done as fake. It's fake compliance. and that's what was done. And the question is, how do you change the field from being fake to being real?
Well, I think that's definitely part of this pathway. I mean, that is why I'm bringing it up. It's not that people haven't used evidence in QI, but there's not really a very strong push or recipe for how to do it, or series of resources for how to do it, and so on. And I think we all, in comparative effectiveness, could bring more into QI if we thought about it, and, you know, all of you young scholars who have, you know, all these years to figure it out can put that in your minds and just think about it. It's also interesting that QI studies are usually excluded from systematic effectiveness reviews, which I think makes sense, actually. I'm not saying it's wrong. They're not the same thing, but I think that validates the point that they're not the same thing. If you look at, for example, the studies of 39 randomized trials for collaborative care for depression, you won't find any of the QI studies on CQI.
And would you say that goes back to what Bob was saying, is a lot of that has to do with the population. You have no control over the population. But if you did a systematic effectiveness review on organizational structure or change, then you might have several QI studies in that.
Yeah, you might. But those are hard to find too, and we'll get to that. So this is one way to look at context. This is the way our center, with participation from UCLA, UCLA School of Public Health, RAND, everybody kind of got together. We got all these social scientists, and they created boxes that they thought were the most efficient set of boxes for representing context. You know, this was a long time ago. But they talked about the environment being policy and, you know, whether you're rural, urban, big or little, kind of those big surrounding issues, the organization and practice, which included, you know, they tied it all to various theories, but it included things that are similar to what's in the chronic illness care model, those kinds of organizational features. So what's in the practice, what's close to the practice. The provider, we know that provider attitudes and age and, you know, all kinds of things, Bob studied a lot of that over the years, affect how the provider behaves in a clinical setting. And by provider behavior, I mean the interaction between the patient and the provider, really getting to that point. And the patient in the encounter, a walk-in visit, the behavior is different for a walk-in visit than for a scheduled visit, for one kind of patient versus another. We have a lot of evidence on how all those factors affect provider behavior. So context and quality improvement interventions are intertwined, and the QIIs manipulate aspects of context, and they're also immersed in a broader context. And the classical efficacy methods really emphasize internal validity and eliminate context. And QIIs really don't make any sense if there's not, I mean, they are context, so it's, you can't really make sense of them. And they're also about behavior. That's something that some of our expert panels related to this have emphasized, is the behavioral part, which, you know, kind of draws on that kind of literature and evidence. So I was going to give you just an example from a CQI study that I worked on with primarily Lisa Meredith and Louise Parker at RAND. And it was a cluster randomized trial of what we call evidence-based quality improvement. It was early enough that people were so wedded to the word CQI, we were terrified to use it because they were so critical. If you didn't do everything exactly how it was supposed to be laid out, so we wanted to emphasize that we were trying to go from guidelines, and we were trying to go from evidence on behavior and prior successful models, so really kind of a comparative effectiveness model ported into QI. And what I really am showing you this for is to just give you a sense of the complexity of these kinds of studies. So if you look at, there were six EBQI practices, and there were three usual care practices. So prior to the intervention, we enrolled a cross-section of patients as a pre-sample so that we would be able to know, are these practices similar or not? Where is the practice starting? This isn't the patient. This is understanding the context. Then we started at time zero up there in the corner, an EBQI design process. So that was the, you know, a CQI type. They were supposed to implement guidelines, and we gave them a lot of information on what evidence was they could be supposed to use to redesign. Then they had 6 months of PDSA cycles. And then about month eight, the care models were implemented. Now, what you can see is that the experimental group, unlike the experimental group in a lot of effectiveness studies, includes a lot of patients who weren't exposed to the model. They're still randomly selected into the intervention group. And I think this is something that often people overlook when they look at these studies of CQI. They don't kind of make the leap from an effectiveness study has an enrolled sample that goes into an intervention and marches through, versus most of the CQI randomized trials are basically, it's a shill patient walking into the site, and does that shill patient get something that they were supposed to get in the site? And then we followed it through and looked at what happened compared to the control group. So there's a big exposure piece in these CQI studies. And that also goes to something that's been called reach or adoption. A key design question in these things is, you know, what is the scope of this thing? In the MHAP study, all those patients essentially were the reference sample for this. This was a representative sample of this 100 and a million and something in all of those experimental sites. So the intervention then had to be big enough to affect a random patient walking into the site over a four-month period, which really was not very linked to what the site was doing. They were supposed to have their intervention up and going when we got there. And the providers were blind about which patients were in the study, so that, you know, it could be any patient. So how did this particular study turn out? Considering all sites, the intervention increased patient involvement in decision making and social function, but didn't improve depression outcomes. Now, people would have been very happy to publish the study just like that. But I'm telling you, it took Bob Rook and a lot of people's help to try to write this study so that it would be published with its context. Because we really felt that if we didn't do that, it really wasn't telling the truth. So we also asked the question, can sites that are ready and implement an evidence-based program improve outcomes? And that was yes for depression process of care and depression outcomes. So if you were in a site that implemented something that looked evidence-based by what we know about what works for depression, then you saw improvement in depression outcomes. If you were at a site, like one of our sites was, they had off-site mental health, and they assigned the project to a part-time internist, and she basically said, I think brightly enough, all I can do is get them ready to do this. They aren't really gonna do something major. So if I spend my time just educating, bringing the pharmacist in, bringing the nurses in, trying to get this thing going, that'll be the best way I can spend my time. And interestingly enough, several years after the study, they published another study on improving care for depression that was effective, that they had put together themselves, you know, out of this. So that's sort of a readiness example. But just because, I mean, smart quality improvers may not always think that the best thing for them to do is to go ahead and implement this thing. In this particular study and in a bunch of other studies, we've looked at readiness in the sites and organizational readiness, and sort of similar to patient readiness. And it tends to be pretty well linked to what happens.
Is
that include financial revenues? It seems paying for it is such a critical element.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm trying to think if that we have some, not in this study, in another study we have something called organizational slack, which I think is sort of related. But I don't think we actually have something called like financial stress at the organizational level. That would be really interesting.
That would be positive.
Yeah, probably.
Lisa,
yeah.
Do you think that organizations are looking at that more, the sort of the cost issue? And you know, rather than sort of, you know, previously perhaps organizations would be a little bit more willing to try out different things because they're supported. But now, you know, they don't want to put in that time investment unless there's a likelihood that the whatever intervention is going to be implemented will be at least sustainable. And is that sort of work into this?
Oh yeah, I think organizations have less slack in all kinds of ways at the moment. And I think they're also getting more sophisticated about asking questions about the evidence base and those sorts of things. But I think you can still start things small, and there a lot of organizations will try something, especially if it's evidence based in a small way. Kind of goes along with the Rogers view of, you know, seeing if something, you can see if it works and try it out. And
so do you think there's one clinician in any academic institution that believes if they don't do their job consistently and well, the organization's going to go out of business? It's not more money. It's losing your job, going out of business. I mean, all other businesses, whether for-profit or not-for-profit, have to face something that deals with. And you believe there's a single doctor anywhere that actually believes that their performance is tied to anything about the organization anywhere. One single doctor.
I think a lot of primary care and QI people do. I mean, I think.
So on house staff, they're going through something. When a person decides they just will jeopardize another intern or resident just for the hell of it, because they want to go to a party the next night and they got to get their hair done, and they do it, and the organization does nothing. I mean, I'm just really arguing whether we have any belief, we're still at a point, that there's anywhere that anybody believes that producing a consistent, valuable clinical product is related to anything. I mean, is there a single doctor anywhere that really believes that? One single doctor, find me one. They can't do it, they haven't done it yet at Intermountain. I mean, I really believe, we believe that we're God. And because doctors believe we're God and we're treated like God, and people talk about more money as opposed to, well, you're going to get paid nothing this year because you caused one infection in an email intensive care unit. And you did it. You didn't wash your hands, and we have video of you. You're gone. And you lose your license. I mean, that's what would happen if a pilot gets on a plane drunk for Southwest Airlines. I mean, they're out. They're gone.
If a surgeon operates drunk, they're out.
No, they're not. 5% of surgeons operate drunk. Actually, the number in academics, we have data. And the academics done nothing. 5 to 8% of all academic doctors are alcoholic or drug impaired by the data that we now currently have.
Okay.
I mean, and we do nothing about it.
Okay, we're going to go big. I'll say, I believe that one issue with that is that we think too top-down. We don't think enough ground-up. And that people try to solve problems like that top-down. And you can't really have accountability top-down for a big thing. You have to get things on the ground that actually work and find who's having the problem and get people close to the problem noticing it. So I see it.
So the message in academics, which you and I have had, you can tell me your career life, I've had multiple conversations about, that the only thing that's valued in an academic institution is 3 published papers a year, each of which is 15 pages with 15 pages with 5 tables and 22 references, and then you get promoted, and nothing else matters.
Well, I think if we tie that to...
And you don't think that has to be changed before you can do QI?
I think that could be changed, but I also think publications are important, so I'll get to that too. All right. Just in that particular study, which didn't have the very biggest effect, we still would have influenced an awful lot of people given that our sample was random. So what does this mean for comparative effectiveness research? How is comparative effectiveness research going to think about these things? Think about the scope, think about reach and adoption and all of those other things. This is the RE-AIM framework. I think that comparative effectiveness research outcomes should start to really index to these kinds of things. It's not that everything should be phrased that way, but you should know when you read something. This is an intervention that was done for 100 people that were selected and put into the intervention. This other intervention was done for whoever walked in the door, and the intervention had to be strong enough and big enough to take in whoever needed it in that site. I mean, those are very different kinds of studies. And effectiveness, we've talked about, but adoption, you know, how many, we found in another study that the provider, whether the provider was an early adopter, had more influence on the outcome of collaborative care for depression than the patient characteristics, including hold time, like severity and comorbidity and everything else. So if you were a provider who was not an adopter of collaborative care, which has a care manager, and the primary care provider kind of has to use the care manager, then basically your patients had bad outcomes even referred to care management. The care management just didn't work if the primary care provider, you know, wasn't in gear. So there are a lot of things like that hidden in all of this. And spread and maintenance are other things that, you know, maybe you have the evidence for what you're doing and you believe that it's solid evidence. Maybe your main goal is to spread and maintain. That may be the only thing you're designing your study for, because you know this works and you just basically want to prove that it worked, say, reasonably well for the patients who were in your study. You want to think that you met something like the research impact for a group of people enrolled, but your real goal may be, how many sites did this go to? How long did it stay in those sites? And those cause design trade-offs that I think comparative effectiveness hasn't really thought about yet. Okay, shifting gears a little. I think we've talked some about this, so I'm gonna skip through this. Just to say that reporting of context is a big issue now, and Paul Schickel and a study that I was also participating in, Stephanie Taylor, got patient safety people together, and they had the most awful time trying to figure out what should be reported. This was their list of high priorities. And some of the things I don't think you just think of off the top of your head, like regulatory requirements. I mean, if you don't know the regulatory requirements around something, how are you going to read that study? So that's all, you know, it's pieces of a puzzle that haven't come together yet. There's like, I don't know, I know of at least 5 major efforts on context. I'm sure other people know other ones. So we don't have an answer yet, but we know that we got to figure some of it out. So how do you connect literature synthesis to comparative effectiveness research for QI? We started a bunch of research, Paul Schickel and I primarily, on this topic because, just partly out of frustration, because it's so difficult to put all of these different aspects into a paper that makes sense to somebody. We know that if we just stick with randomized trials, as I said before, I believe it can be harmful. I believe that there are fields that have been harmed by large randomized trials that were on care models that really involved a lot of context and were analyzed like a classic randomized trial. So you say, you know, this thing, primary care. Primary care, randomized primary care or not primary care doesn't work. Well, what does that mean? I mean, something labeled primary care doesn't work. How does that? But then everyone who wants to say primary care doesn't work for 10 years says, oh, but this randomized trial showed that X didn't work. You know, or CQI, that's been done a lot with CQI. Very complicated studies, like we've been talking about, didn't work. Oh, CQI doesn't work. Anyone wants to do anything about CQI, doesn't work. So we wanted to try to work on making things easier. We kind of saw it as a long, slow project. And we wanted to be able to identify and judge QII more. We ended up, the people on our little team have ended up writing up a bunch of things. We never intended to do that, but it's got so complicated each step that it's like we have to stop and say what it is. One thing we first came up with is, for QI, there's a QI method, and that method, if you're looking at evidence-based things, is probably trying to implement some other structural change. So there's a change method and what we ended up calling a change package. That's one thing that makes this a little more complicated to think about and analyze. QI articles are heterogeneous. We asked experts to identify important articles in this field, and they came up with four types, some of which are what you see up there, some of which are effectiveness. The first one's effectiveness. The rest are other things that are also essential, and I think, you know, more essential in QI than in some things. There's no conventional labeling for QII in Medline or in any of the databases. We validated a search strategy and came up with, we validated against a bunch of different article collections, including the one from our experts. This is a very simplified version of the search you have to do for this kind of stuff to even get, you know, we got up to, say, 64% of articles. It's a very heterogeneous wording. We got 9,000 articles, of which 272, when we looked at titles and abstracts, were potentially relevant, and 151 really panned out on full article review, so it's quite a bit of work. So we found QIIs, now could we find CQI? We consider it a specific method among quality improvement types of things. And we did a panel that to try to get agreement. These were two characteristics of CQI they agreed on. But when we reviewed the literature, we took this through another broader expert panel. There are all kinds of disagreements in the field. The online panel showed, for example, the people who are practitioners have a little different view than the people who are more on the research side. But this was the list of potentially definitional features that came out of all this, and there was reasonable agreement on them in the end. The feedback of systematically collected data is the one that had the most agreement. And most of the articles ended up having, well, 64% had those. But you can see how in that far right column, which is the percent of articles with the features, of the ones that screened in as having, you know, looking like they had something, it's very, very heterogeneous still. About half of all quality improvement intervention literature articles had some feature, but only one had all six. So how do we learn about across, you know, how is it not just one off for everyone unless we can find these things? If you look at CQI literature reviews, a lot of them are quite arbitrary selections of articles because there isn't a systematic way, and most of them don't describe any systematic selection process. And when we looked at the articles, there are a lot of issues. A lot of issues with how the interventions reported, not very much on context. Almost all of the articles were pre-post. And it was quite amazing that the majority didn't even have an end. When you look at what's in the published literature, searched electronically, most of them didn't even put an end. a lot reported qualitative data, but with no methods. And there's almost no information, interestingly, on privacy. It's like you go out of the IRB world and there ain't nothing. And the discussions really didn't pull in a lot. So, you know, this is my last one. So they always say in QI, this is the slogan they always use, knowing is not enough, we must apply, willing is not enough, we must do. But I also think that doing for ourselves is not enough. We have to learn how to learn from what all of us do if we're really going to make a dent. And, you know, I personally think that all of our health services research training is a tremendous resource for moving this field along, especially if we, you know, push ourselves out there a little farther on that continuum. Mm. I think we have very few minutes for some additional questions or comments. Yeah.
Do you, so you talked about, you know, the science of quality of human and moving forward, and I guess when you look at medical science, I mean, maybe 10, 15 years ago, it was enough to have something that worked. Now the question is, does it work and at what cost? So what do you have to say about the cost of doing all of these things?
The cost of?
Say, I mean, not studying the science of quality improvement, but can you answer the question of, you know, is for a business, for a hospital that has to put this into effect, what does it cost and what do they get out of it?
A CQI project.
A CQI
project, it looks like it costs between $100,000 and $200,000, the best we can guess from across the few studies that have systematically investigated it. But they all do seem to come out there. Now, most places that invest that want to see that it goes for more than one site. And most of them at this point would want them to be evidence-based in terms of at least guidelines. Not too many places are that sophisticated about the behavior part. So, you know, when is it worth it to invest $100,000? I don't think it's worth it if it's not going to go anywhere. And we've done qualitative interviews of CQI participants, and they also don't believe it's worth it if it doesn't go anywhere, like spread, sustain, you know, those kinds of things. It's not cheap. I think there's a lot of waste in quality improvement at the moment.
So if you had $10 million of federal money.
Yeah.
What would you spend it on?
Oh boy. $10 million.
I mean, I'm talking about public money. I'm saying if you wanted to do something to greatly advance something that you talked about, improving quality, what would you invest the money? What would your advice to Carolyn Clancy be?
Well, I think that, I don't know that it's $10 million, but I think that there's...
What number do you want?
I think that the problems in healthcare are too complex for simple policy solutions. And I think that the best thing that can be done in a lot of areas now is systematic quality improvement that leads to models that can be tested for their effectiveness and then be subjected to policy at a level where
if I was listening to that and I was the head of research at the moment, I would give you no money. I'm serious. It doesn't answer the question. It's invasive. It's worse than, you know, it doesn't answer the question. I mean, where would you put, you are the expert in the world. And if you were going to write a case for $100 million or $1 billion, or I don't care, where would you put them? Somebody had to write a case for competitive effectiveness, and they got $1 billion. If you were going to put a case here for government-supported dollars to do something, what would you support? It was really, I'll give you one of the answers that came out. There is not a single doctor that we train in the country right now that is fluid at going from cost analysis to anything that resembles quality improvement methodology. and knows Bayesian statistics. We don't train a single person in the United States 20 years after this. After
I could go for that one. I'd spend some of my $10 million on that. That sounds good.
I mean, I was stunned. And some everyone comes up to ask me, do you have anybody that can do this, that's trained to do this? The answer is, where? I don't know a single person that really knows this. If one could develop a curriculum to actually do that, that ought to probably be the only, and as I thought about it, after looking at your work, I was saying, maybe we ought to not fund a similar, another thing out of government money. Everything else should be funded by the institution that's going to benefit from it. And that the real issue is to fund the people who actually would have a skill set to really start the curriculum, and then eventually you don't have to fund it anymore. But there's nobody that trains those people.
Well, I think you make a very good point. I do. Well, I mean, that does go to that goes to another layer of what the ground up is. You know, how can you not think beyond policies that are so coarse that nothing really is going to work, and they don't really have a very good aim to go for if they don't have people like you're saying. But I think we're at the end, so I want to thank you all for your attention and comments, and you know, certainly welcome any more thoughts, because you know, definitely this is not something that's cooked and going to be this way forever. Thanks.